This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
I'm not sure if the expletive came out of Blake Snell's mouth as Kevin Cash first stepped foot out of the dugout, or he had to take a couple of steps toward the mound, but the product out of Shoreline was someone who was less than enthused to see his manager coming to get him, and as it turned out, Blake Snell was right. We might have had one of the bigger World Series gaffes if Grady Little suffered to leave Pedro Martinez out too long in the playoffs. What do you think about Kevin Cash's decision to have a quick hook with Blake Snell?
Awful. Danny, I was watching the game on mute because I traditionally do this with a lot of baseball games. I'll listen to podcasts. I saw him getting pulled, and I thought to myself, wait, did I miss something commentary-wise that explains this? He'd thrown 73 pitches. It had been 5 1/3 innings. He was the 2018 Cy Young Award winner. The Dodgers had yet to score. It was a 1-0 game. I mean, clearly he got hurt. Clearly something bad happened. Nope. And right away, Mookie Betts hits a double, and the rest is history, and the Dodgers go on to win the World Series. Danny, you talked about expletives coming out of Blake Snell's mouth. There were expletives coming out of my mouth, and I had no real rooting interest in this game.
The World Series ends. The Dodgers win 3-1. They clinch in 6 games. We've got a guy who tested positive for COVID. The results found out mid-game. He's partying on the field afterward without a mask. We'll get into that in a little bit. Maybe a very 2020 end to an odd sports calendar. The decision-making and that question, you asked it this way, Paul. Is there any mistake that a coach or manager, that a person in a position of authority can make that's quite like mismanaging your pitching staff in a crucial game, either leaving your starter out there too long or pulling him too quick? Is it the worst thing that coach/manager can do?
Maybe the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line 710-710 can help us, Danny, because I can't think of anything worse. You leave the guy in too long and he gets shelled, like in 2003 with Grady Little, keeping Pedro Martinez in against the New York Yankees in Game 7 of the 2003 American League Championship Series, or you pull the guy too early and you see an avalanche of runs. And I guess it's not an avalanche, but it's enough with the way that the Rays were hitting that night after the first inning. I can't think of anything that's worse. I mean, basketball coaches don't have that much power. A football coach can make a bad play call, a bad clock management decision. Maybe they decide to go for it on a fourth down that they're not supposed to, or go for two in a situation where it's not the smartest idea, like with the Titans and Texans a week and a half ago. Can you think of something that's worse?
The fourth down and decision to go for it or kick, that's probably as close as you get. But even then, I don't think it's the same, because you see the result of the play. And then there's with the manager, when they make that decision, it's almost like regardless of the outcome, even if the best you can hope for is people that are going to be indifferent to it and think you messed up, even though it doesn't bite you in the butt, right? If they go to his bullpen, Kevin Cash goes to his bullpen, replaces Blake Snell, they get out of the inning, people are still going to think that he pulled Snell too soon. It just won't have bit them. And they think that you dodged a bullet rather than, oh, that was really smart. Most of the other ones, there's a chance to be right. When you mismanage your starter, there's everyone sure you're wrong, and you might be really dumb or you might get away with it. There's no chance where people are like, oh, he really knew what he was doing there. Kevin Cash, do I want to defend him?
No.
Do I want to provide?
No, there's no defense. What's the defense?
The defense is the bullpen, and their bullpen is the reason they're here. That Tampa Bay has the deepest hard throwing bullpen in the league, in Major League Baseball. And that was his team's strength, and he managed that game to the strength of his team, which is the bullpen. That's the defense.
That's even a stretch, because you still have to get to Game 7. And
yeah,
guess what? You're going to need that bullpen in Game 7, if you can even get to Game 7. And it was a one-run game. I suppose that maybe Kevin Cash thought to himself, Mookie Betts has struck out twice. there's no way he is striking out three times against Blake Snell. But he hit a double, you know? And then he hits the home run to ice the game in the eighth inning. So I still can't defend it, you know? The only way that this would have made sense is if the Rays were winning. And they thought, you know what, we might need Blake Snell for game seven. So they're up 7-0, and they think to themselves, yep, we've got this one in the bag. Let's put the bullpen in. There's no way they're scoring seven runs over the next couple of innings. By the way, they didn't. I can't defend this one. I feel like you even are fishing here to
no, no, I'm not. Because ultimately, look, Blake Snell is one of their, I think he's their best player. You mentioned it, he's a Cy Young Award winner. He was also throwing his best. I watched him when there was a game against the Mariners. He was going up against Felix, and he struck out the first seven batters he faced against Seattle. Like, it was clear that he was amped up to come home. He's a product of Shorewood High School. He came here spitting fire. He looked that way this game. He looked, and there was a runner on first. You're up 1-0 off a home run you got in the first inning. I think you have to let it ride. Your best player, in my mind, your best player is cruising. Let's listen to what Blake Snell had to say after the game about the decision to remove him. 5 1/3 inning, he left with a runner on first. That runner ended up scoring in addition to Mookie Betts, who had doubled earlier in the inning. The Rays end up losing 3-1. Here's Blake Snell.
No, I mean, definitely disappointed, upset. You know, I don't know. I just want the ball. I felt good. I did everything I could to, you know, prove my case to stay out there. You know, it's going to be tough, man. Like, I get it's a third time through the lineup, but, I mean, I think I'm going to make the adjustments I need to make as I see them, you know, a third time. I think, I don't know, man. I just believe in me. I believe in my stuff. I believe in, you know, what I was doing. I didn't walk nobody. They had two, you know, hits up the middle, you know, the slider to Barnes, you know, tip your cap. That was a bad pitch. And he got a hit off that. Good job. But for most of that game, man, I was dominating every outcome possible.
That sounds like a guy who never wants to play for Kevin Cash again. I mean, you just hear in his voice. How do you feel confident going forward that your manager has confidence in you? And I know that baseball's changed and we don't see pitchers pitch past six innings very often anymore, and that the Rays do have this great bullpen. But what's the point of having a starting pitcher if you're going to pull him after 73 pitches when he is lights out? Two hits were allowed to that point, and that was the first one to open up that inning. And they said, yeah, that's enough.
I want to give Blake Snell credit because I think he's really professional there.
I think
you hear what he feels, which is that, hey, I thought I did everything I could to show them that I should stay in the game. I want to stay in the game. I don't feel good about being taken out. But he didn't get downright sort of rebellious, right? And saying, like, you saw how the decision turned out. He's going to have to live with that. He stayed very, very professional. But you hear very clearly. And honestly, that's the mentality you want in a player. You don't want a player that wants to come out of the game at that point. You don't want a player that defers. You want a player that shows that. You want a player that shows a little bit of the it's the pitcher with the Nationals who has the heterochromia, who will yell at you when you set foot out of the mound, like he doesn't want you coming out.
Oh, Scherzer.
Do not come out here to get the ball. Yes. Max Scherzer, who will absolutely you want that eye of the tiger, and he had that. At the end of the day, I don't know.
He has to live with that the rest of his life, Danny. He has to live with the fact that that was taken from him the rest of his life. I would be furious. What's the chances that the Rays get back to the World Series? I don't think that they are that high. Yeah, they had the best record in the American League this year, but you know that this team is essentially operating on a MacGyver budget, and that to get back to this place, it's going to take unbelievable pitching over the course of the playoffs. Once again, I would be furious right now if I'm Blake Snell. In fact, I think I'd want out. I don't know that I can play for a guy that clearly did not have enough faith in me in this spot.
Paul, you mentioned decisions, and is this the worst one we can make?
Of course.
I have deliberately tiptoed around it because I don't want to bring up the Super Bowl, because I think the play that they called was wrong. But I don't think the decision to throw in that situation was wrong. I think they should have thrown something with a lower percentage chance of success that had very low. I think they should have thrown a fade. I think they should have thrown a fade, which is a horrible note. But you know what? A fade, you don't get picked on a fade. You don't get picked on a fade. They threw over the middle. The combination. No, they needed to throw on one of the three plays. We can get in. Here's the similarity. If you're going to lose, you want to lose with your best player in position to make the play. If you're going to lose, and that's the reason that it hurts that Marshawn Lynch, he would have been running against a goal line set, but if you're going to lose, you want it in your best player's hands. Like that should be the job number one of every coach, right? Like if I'm going down, I'm going down with my best player having the ball in his hands. And Kevin Cash made the decision to take the ball out of the hands of his best player who was playing his best.
Take Sunday night, 3rd and 2. You hand it off to Carlos Hyde. You got Russell Wilson. It's one of those things that we see so often in sports. It's a case of overthinking, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You outsmart yourself. I thought you were going to say on Monday night, you want the ball in the hands of your best player. That's why the Rams punted so well.
Johnny Hecker, man, he looked good.
Yeah, he looked absolutely fantastic. It is Danny Gallant. It's time for us to tell you what to watch for.
What to watch for every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
Paying attention to the trade market out there? It started to move in the NFL. Everson Griffin dealt from the Cowboys to the Detroit Lions. How about that? The Lions making an acquisition. They're a better spot to be right now than Dallas. A conditional, was it a sixth-round pick?
Conditional sixth, yes.
And the Lions pick up about $1.6 million. And this has cued the hand-wringing, the teeth-gnashing, the wailing over why didn't Seattle make this move.
I'm not someone who was that gung-ho about getting Everson Griffin this offseason, and I go back to that incident in Minnesota in 2018, because I think that's a bit of a red flag as far as can you trust this guy to keep himself in the right state of mind to be consistently reliable for you. The Seahawks, for whatever reason, whether it was the draft where he was available and Pete Carroll, he knew him very well coming out of that draft this offseason or here, something they just don't see in him. But I can understand where you get to a point where you think to yourself, are you really good enough to say this guy's not good enough for my defense?
What to watch for?
It's also weird that the Lions are being aggressive after wins over the Jaguars and Falcons, but
they're feeling frisky, man.
Yeah.
That, you know what that smells like? That smells like a man who needs to make the playoffs to keep his job.
Mm.
You smell that? Smell that? It's the whiff of desperation.
It's also Matt Patricia's beard. There might be pieces of meat in it. Justin Turner tested positive for COVID-19 in the middle of Game 6. Speaking of guys with beards, he was pulled from the game. No one really had any idea why that happened. But then after the game, we found out that he had tested positive in the midst of celebration. This got really confusing because Justin Turner tweets after the World Series win, "Thanks to everyone for reaching out. I feel great. No symptoms at all. Just experienced every emotion you could possibly imagine. Can't believe I couldn't be out there to celebrate with my guys. So proud of this team and unbelievably happy for the city of Los Angeles." So unless the guy playing Tormund from Game of Thrones stepped in for Justin Turner, Danny, we saw photos and video of Justin Turner out on the field holding the piece of metal, as Rob Manfred describes it, and sitting down without a mask next to Dave Roberts, manager of the Dodgers and a cancer survivor.
He shouldn't have been celebrating, right? Like, we know this. I'm having a hard time getting a lot of indignation worked up, and it's not because I don't think that's a valid point. He did test positive. What we know about the risk and the possibility, it seems like a celebration where people are spraying each other with champagne, where they're embracing, like all of those things would, that's not a, he's asymptomatic. He's spent the past couple days around them. There's part of me that's like, you shouldn't have done it, but I understand why it happened. And I don't want to make too big a deal about it because I think that that would be climbing up on the moral high horse to prove a point.
Astros fans have been rather insufferable today about this side of it. And
what I get,
calm
right?
down.
Like you should. You
but
shouldn't.
They're saying asterisk for this World Series title because of that,
because
you know?
It's a celebration.
Yeah,
no,
that's a reach.
I think the question is, did people really believe in the safety protocols or did they really believe on giving a chance to play? And I think that question of how big a risk this actually was, he does not have symptoms still. still a little bit. I get the objection to it. I get the objection to it. I'm just not going to go head over heels. And they're right. He shouldn't have. But I also kind of understand why it would be an exceptional circumstance here.
I'm with you. I'm not really outraged. And is it his fault that he didn't find out about this until the second inning either? I mean, geez, baseball. Get some results a little quicker. My goodness, it's the deciding game of the World Series.
What to watch for.
We also have a little bit of an update for the Seattle Seahawks. They released Anthony Rush, who has been one of the big body defensive tackles there. This would be a clear sign that they're expecting Damon Harrison, Snacks Harrison, to play this week. He was signed as a free agent. He hasn't played the past two games, though he's been available. Now it looks like we can expect him to play.
That's somewhat exciting because you're looking for that reinforcement on the defensive side of things. And it does feel like a really long time ago that we found out that the Seahawks were bringing in Snacks Harrison. He's going to need to make some sort of an impact. I don't think it's going to come from a pass rushing perspective, but if you got a big body in the middle that's occupying space, maybe that frees up other guys.
That is what to watch for. It's time to bring in the professor. John Clayton joins us now.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by DivorceLawyersForMen.com.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, did the Seahawks miss out in not trading for Everson Griffin?
Yeah, they probably did because I thought that was a great option. But the problem is they couldn't fit his current salary in their cap. They're about $1.3 million of cap room at the moment. Now, again, they can free things up. You know, they can make some moves. They can go into a contract and replace signing bonus, base salary with signing bonus, so they can do that. But, he came for the price that I thought it was going to be. Because a lot of these deals are going to be sixth, seventh round picks, or you trade a sixth and you get a seventh back and all those different things. And so, I think that they missed a pretty good chance to pick up a pass rusher. I mean, he has 2.5 sacks. He played for Pete Carroll. I know there was some question right now about his problems a couple years ago when he was in Minnesota and kind of went off the deep end a little bit. So I know there's concerns there, but that was one option, and now it's no longer an option.
Other options that are out there, Carlos Dunlap is someone who has been told to stay home by the Cincinnati Bengals, but I also just saw a tweet from Bob Condotta saying he's owed like $13.5 million next season.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Like, we've got an $11.5 million base this season, so it's like, if you can't fit a one-year $6 million deal into your cap, then it's going to be really hard to fit that Dunlap deal in there. Now, one thing I was kind of thinking about this morning, okay, what you know that they have a lot of issues on the offensive line with injuries and all that stuff. In fact, I think they're in the process of signing Quentin Spain, who played for the Buffalo Bills, who was just cut last week. Could they propose, because they've also got issues at tight end, they can maybe propose saying, okay, will you take B.J. Finney and Jacob Hollister? And, that could at least fill in some of the cap room that you might need to do a Dunlap deal. And, again, it does fit the needs because the Bengals starting tight end blew out an ACL, so he's done for the year, and they have issues with injuries at the guard position. So, that could be one way to do it. But when you're starting talking about, Ryan Kerrigan, you're talking about Dunlap, I mean, the numbers just don't work unless you try to really free up cap room.
The Bengals also seem like one of those teams that would require you to pay every single cent of Carlos Dunlap's salary, and you would need them, some team that you're making a deal with, to do a little bit of you're going to pay a little bit of that salary? That might make it a little bit more expensive for you. And you mentioned Ryan Kerrigan, Carlos Dunlap. What other options are realistic at this point? We have seen several names floated, but those guys have been generally at the top of most people's lists. I know J.J. Watt's been mentioned, but he's even more expensive than Carlos Dunlap. Who else do you think that the Seahawks could be eyeing?
Well, it looks like there's a fire sale going on with the Dallas Cowboys. Not that these two players fit the needs here, but they told Dontari Poe and Daryl Worley, Poe a defensive tackle and Worley a cornerback, to stay home because they're going to either get cut or traded. I'd start to maybe look at Alden Smith. Smith because he's got a one-year, $1.25 million contract, and he's done a pretty good job at least doing some rushing. And so that could be an option right there because that would certainly fit into the cap. But you know, now it looks like the Cowboys are sellers and trying to get rid of everything. But I think what you do is you go up and down the list of teams that, the 10 or 11 teams that are pretty much already out of it. And I guess even if you're Dallas, you're almost thinking you're out of it. Even in a division, it's only going to be 5-6 wins when you've already traded away Griffin and you got two other guys that you've told to go home and stay home until we find a way to either cut you or trade you.
What's going on with Mike Thomas in New Orleans? He was suspended a game. He played this past week, right? But he barely got any looks.
And I heard...
No, he didn't play.
Right.
He was inactive. He had a hamstring injury.
He was inactive. He was a healthy scratch again?
No, he had a hamstring injury. Ankle injury, he had a hamstring, and so the hamstring caused him to miss the game.
Do you buy that 100%? And I only ask that because Sean Payton was clapping back at people on Twitter who were asking what's going on. I was listening to the Ryan Russillo podcast yesterday. You know that Thomas's Twitter handle is Can't Guard Mike, and I guess people around the locker room have been giving him the nickname Can't Stand Mike. What's going on here? Like, there's got to be some thought in New Orleans, hey, let's try to ship this guy out.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, to ship him out this year, number one, they realize who's going to take on an $18 million contract, and they're trying to win this year. And right now, where they went into the season thinking that they were going to stay ahead of Tampa Bay, now they're trying to catch up to Tampa Bay. And so, it's a little bit of a challenge in that regard. So I think that, they're trying to, I guess, build a case that they can get out of next year's base salary guarantee. And, he's punched out a teammate. You saw that. That got the one-game suspension. Then he's, been, I guess, yelling at trainers, yelling at different people. I don't know how he is as far as going to meetings and stuff like that, but you can definitely say that he's been a diva and he's been a pain, but at the moment, it's just trying to get him healthy. Because, again, that's a high ankle sprain, and those are usually, 4 to 6 weeks, so he's still in that period, and now he got the hamstring injury, so it's a mess.
Did we know he was hurt going into this past game, or did
yes.
he just suddenly show
no,
up? So they
no.
they ruled him out?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. They ruled him out. They ruled him out on Friday.
So
I still think it's fishy.
This would be my question. With Mike Thomas, is it possible that the suspension for punching a teammate was that he was just hurt and they wanted the other team to prepare for him? And then at the last minute, you can't suddenly crop up with an injury because then the NFL got suspicious. So instead, they're like the day of the game. We're like, he's suspended because he punched a teammate. And that way, he misses the game. They prepared for it the whole week. I'm very suspicious here, John.
It's, no, I mean, the punch out was on a Friday. So it's like, and I think didn't they play on Monday or something like that week? So no, I don't think there's any kind of conspiracy theory or anything like that. It's just a matter, one, you have an injured superstar considered that going into the year is the best receiver in football. And, he's acted up, but he suffered a high ankle sprain. I mean, you could see from the way that he had when he got the injury that it was a serious one. So, I think that you can, because honestly, were it not for the hamstring, I don't even know if he was going to be able to play with the ankle because, again, he hasn't practiced.
Presumptive first overall pick in the NFL draft, Trevor Lawrence, had this to say yesterday when asked about his future.
We'll just have to see how things unfold. I think there's a lot of factors in that. But honestly, just really playing this year, putting everything I have into it, not really focusing on next year, whether, I leave or stay, whatever. Obviously, I have the option to do either one. Kind of my mindset's been that I'm going to move on. But who knows? There's a lot of things that could happen. So just really focusing on this year, not trying to look ahead, not trying to worry about that. Obviously, I can't control it, and really just trusting that God has a plan for me no matter where that is, no matter where I go, whether that's across the country, whether that's close to home, where I stay another year, no matter what it is, we'll work it out. So I'm not sure. That's a tough one, but we'll see how it all unfolds.
John, does that sound like a man trying to avoid the New York Jets?
Could be, yeah. But also, remember, Joe Burrow did the same thing thinking about it because his father didn't want him to become a Bengal because the Bengals have been so bad in recent years and had such a history of not doing well. And that rumor was out there, but he did put his name into the draft. He was the first pick, and he's really embracing the idea of being a Bengal. So I think that Trevor's doing the best football thing right now is thinking about what's on his plate at the moment in college and then worrying about it later. So, but, you know, certainly in the back of his mind, he's got to say, now, do I really want to go to the Jets? That could be an issue. But right now, I think that at least that was an honest answer, talking about, okay, let's concentrate on this thing right now, and we'll worry about the next thing later.
Professor, we always appreciate it, and I appreciate you setting me straight on Mike Thomas, too. We'll look forward to talking to you tomorrow. Thanks so much, man.
Okay, thanks.
That is John Clayton. We talk to him each and every day here at 7:30. Did also want to let people know I was absent yesterday from the show. My thanks to DJ Paul and Michael Bumpus for stepping in and filling. My dog Peach, we had to put her to sleep yesterday. And people who've listened to us know how much I love my dog. And she was probably the fiercest. I have never seen anyone fight so hard. And in fact, at the end and that last night, which was really tough, there were moments where I was thinking, like, come on, girl, just give in. And she fought all the way to the end. I've written a little bit about it at 710sports.com. I want to thank everybody for the really kind wishes. I think we gave her a good life here. I hope we did.
I know you did.
I know she made our lives incredibly better, and she's meant a lot to me. She'd kind of been with me through the last 8 years as I'd changed professions, as I'd lost my mom, as I kicked a drinking problem, a lot of different things. And missing her today, but very grateful for the time we had. And again, I appreciate all of the well wishes for everyone.
Yeah, sorry for your loss, buddy. There's nothing like a pet and what they bring to us, joy-wise and happiness. And you gave her a great life, and I know she gave you some really good years along the way.
Yeah, she is going to be missed. Rest in Peach, in peace to Peach the Pay. It is Danny and Gallant. We'll talk about Seattle's defense and the fact that maybe they can't afford to be so passive. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
This might be a bit of a dated reference, which is strange that I bring so many of these to the table, given that I'm 31 years old, Danny, but I started thinking last night about the Naked Gun. You know that scene where Frank Drebin, he gets in front of the fireworks store, which has just exploded, and is telling everybody, disperse, please disperse, nothing to see here.
All right, move on, nothing to see here, please disperse, nothing to see here, please.
I feel like I'm about to do this with the Seahawks defense. We all know it's giving up a lot of yards. We all know it's giving up a lot of points. They're struggling to get off the field on third downs. They're struggling to get after the passer. But there is an element of Sunday's loss that has to do with the fact that Kyler Murray's just difficult to prepare for. He's a truly special quarterback, and they don't go up against many, Danny, the rest of the way.
No, it's true. And if listening to Pete Carroll with us on Monday, I heard very clearly Pete say it's the plan, not the personnel. Saying, hey, look, he completed less than half his passes in the previous game, so we decided, don't let anybody behind you, give him a big cushion, dare him to make the throws underneath. And we don't think he's accurate enough to beat us that way. In fact, we think he's probably going to give us some interceptions, and he gave him one. And he said in the afternoon that we won't play them that way again. We won't do that. So that's encouraging from this respect, is you want it to be the plan, not the personnel, when you have a result like that. Because if it's the plan, it means you can just arrange your pieces differently and give them different orders. And that question of, okay, let's look at the quarterbacks that they face going forward. I think you're right. And especially after watching the way Jimmy Garoppolo, the way Jared Goff's playing, especially the way Goff's playing. Goff's off.
Almost three interceptions on Monday. Yes, against a good Bears defense still.
By the third quarter of that game, honestly, I felt like this game could have another eight quarters in it. And the Rams aren't going to do anything to put it away, and the Bears aren't going to do anything to win it. It's going to stay exactly like this. These two teams, their quarterbacks are just, they're limited by their quarterbacks.
That game actually gave me a migraine. I had to turn off the television and go to bed, Danny, on Monday night. I'm not kidding. I actually was watching this, and I was like, no, I really can't do this anymore. I have a major headache. I think it's because of the game. I'm out. I am out on this one. And, you know,
now, everybody's going to have to kind of toughen up for just a second, because this was a joke that was made yesterday. That Monday night football game was the last thing that was on TV before things got really bad with our lovely dog Peach.
Oh, Jared Goff.
Sharon Chan made the reference yesterday as we're going, and hats off to Peach, man. She fought like nothing I've ever seen over that evening, but it was a tough night, and it's possible that it was triggered by Peach did not like bad quarterbacking. She did not like a poorly quarterbacked game. And the sight of what was on TV that Monday night might have been the domino that knocked everything downhill. She sounded like they suspected lymphoma last week. She'd already been in kidney failure a couple months ago. Like, it was a tough go of it, but that might have been the straw that broke the Sharpay's back.
Thanks, Jared Goff. Well, hopefully the Seahawks have revenge on their minds.
Nick Foles doesn't get off the hook either.
Yeah,
he was awful too.
We know what Nick Foles is at this point. So Kyler Murray, special as far as quarterbacks go, and I'm with you in that the personnel for the Seahawks needs to be better, but it may have been more game plan for this past Sunday than in the weeks prior to that. In the playoffs, the Seahawks will go up against better quarterbacks. There's a chance that they go up against Kyler Murray again. They, of course, go up against him again in 4 weeks on a Thursday night football game. They will also go up, I would imagine, against either Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady in the playoffs. Brady's playing well. Rodgers is playing lights out. But as far as the Seahawks getting the one seed, I'm going to sound spin zone here. Again, nothing to see here. Please disperse. But as you mentioned, Jared Goff, Jimmy Garoppolo, Carson Wentz, Daniel Jones, Sam Darnold, Kyle Allen, Jared Goff, and Josh Allen the rest of the way. I feel that the Seahawks, even with their major defensive issues where they can't get off the field on third down and can't get after the passer, are going to be able to outscore every single one of those quarterbacks. It won't happen every time, but I think for the most part, like if I had to bet, I would probably bet on the Seahawks in winning a shootout against every single one of those teams.
I think you're right, and I'm not worried about them, the bottom dropping out and them not making the playoffs or being, I don't know if they'll win the division because it's a really good division, but it's not like the result against Arizona makes me drastically recalibrate things. At the same time, the goal isn't to get into the playoffs with the number one seed. And you are going to face better quarterbacks in the playoffs. I do think they need to try and improve the way they play. And that's not just, hey, we just need to do enough to win each week. They absolutely need to be able to succeed against quarterbacks who aren't just going to beat themselves, right? I don't want to see them use that Sunday game plan anymore. I don't want to see them say, okay, you know what? We're going to make sure that this doesn't just bite us in the butt. Like, you've got to find some things that you can do well, regardless of who the opposing quarterback is.
How do you get better without going up against quarterbacks like that, though, along the way?
You've still got to mix in blitzes, and this should get better when Jamal Adams gets here. But you can't, I don't want to see them stay in that shell. I want to see them have their corners get up and get on, guys. Like, come on, let's do it. Like, play, cover. Play bump and run coverage like the Seahawks typically do. Jam the guy at the line of scrimmage. I don't want to see any more 10, 15 yards off the ball like they were in this game, because that's clearly what they were doing. And we talked on Monday that, hey, you know what? The positive side of this is that the receivers didn't carve him up, that they didn't get DeAndre Hopkins. Yeah, he did some damage, but it wasn't like he had 150 yards receiving. And Christian Kirk and the other kid, Andy Isabella, that are so fast. And look, you got to be able to man up. Don't play 10 yards off the ball on third and six. Let's go. Let's enough of that.
How confident, though, do you feel in the Seahawks' ability to do that bump and run when Trey Flowers is a liability? We have to admit this at this point. And also with Quentin Dunbar, against DeAndre Hopkins, he looked overmatched. And specifically that one play down the left sideline, the touchdown pass.
That was a weird play, though, right?
Yeah, he was lost off the line at the start.
It was quick snap,
right? He lost a split second there. But I listening to Brock yesterday, I felt like the entire Quentin Dunbar performance is one that he did not like on Sunday, and that's not good, because who can you rely on at cornerback, especially now where you got Shaquille Griffin in the concussion protocol going into this week? Of course, you're going up against a banged-up 49ers team on Sunday. Still, though, that bump-and-run ability to do that, I don't know if you feel confident in the personnel's ability to do that. And yeah, it would be great if they could get a little bit more seasoning as far as doing that the rest of the way, because they're going to need it, because Aaron Rodgers is looming large over the NFC playoffs. Another matchup against Kyler Murray and figuring out how to stop him, that also looms large. When you don't go up against that the rest of the year, I feel like you sort of run the same danger that the Packers did last season, where they get just bullied by the 49ers run defense, running offense, and then the next time around, there's no answer for it. And I don't know what they really could have done along the way to be better against a power running attack like that, Danny.
If you're power running's different though, right? Than coverage. You can put guys in situations to play bump and run and ask them to do that. And you can make evaluations on whether they're good enough to do that, and if not, go find other guys that can. And it's different if you just get bodied at the line of scrimmage and you can't stop the run game. And what I want to see, I don't want to see them nurse their way through the season with this defense. Because I don't think nursing your way through the season gets you to the Super Bowl. And I think that that's the standard and the expectation here. And the way to get to the Super Bowl is to either teach these players to be able to play more akin to the style that Seattle does, or to find other guys that can and make some changes. And if Trey Flowers can't do that, well, let's see if Ugo Amadi can. He's not built like Seattle likes its outside corners. Let's see some opportunities, because what I fear is exactly what you described, except it won't be a ground game that bulldozes them like Green Bay got bulldozed by, that it's a team that just picks them apart because they're sitting there 10 yards off and waiting for the quarterback to make a mistake. And guess what good quarterbacks don't do? They don't make those mistakes.
He is Danny O'Neill. I am Paul Gallant. I don't mind stealing bread from the mouths of decadence. The Seahawks clearly minded stealing bread, pass rushing bread, though, from the decadent Dallas Cowboys. Did they make a mistake in not trading for Everson Griffin? We'll discuss that next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
I feel like one of the enduring refrains of Pete Carroll's time here in Seattle is the question of, hey, you going to go get Everson Griffin? It happened in the draft, was mentioned when it was looking like he might get to free agency at one point. It's been mentioned repeatedly over the past year as Griffin opted out with the Vikings, then waited on the market, and now it happened again because the Cowboys, who signed him after the Seahawks had taken their time and opted against him, now traded him to the Detroit Lions. And Paul, I've reached the stunning conclusion that the Seahawks may not think all that highly of Everson Griffin and his fit on this team.
Why do you think that is? Because at a certain point, I hate to say this, beggars can't be choosers. You do not have anyone on your defensive line that's commanding extra attention, and I'm not going to act as if I've been watching Everson Griffin film. I don't really want to watch the Dallas Cowboys any more than I have to this year. He has 2.5 sacks on the season. Compared to the rest of the Seahawks, I know that's not the end-all be-all when it comes to pass rushing, but that's better than everyone, isn't it? So can you really say to yourself, yeah, we didn't like him coming out of USC, even though we maybe had a little extra intel on him. We didn't like him this past free agency. We don't like him now with the way that things have been going for the Seahawks pass rush thus far.
I don't think Seattle is stubborn, because that's kind of the one conclusion, which is that they just reached a conclusion and they're unwilling to revisit it. I don't think there's much of a track record for the Seahawks being stubborn. The other possibility is that they're just wrong. They've misevaluated him. And that they consistently choose guys that they think are better than him who are not. And if you think that he's a better fit for this defense than Benson Mayoa, then that would fall into that category. If Seattle just misdiagnosed this, they made the mistake. I also think that Seattle doesn't like guys who only rush the passer. And this might relate to why they weren't as interested in Yannick Ngakoue. That they don't want guys that they perceive and believe will be a liability in the run game, that's just not something Pete's interested in. And it probably has to do with that they ask one of their defensive ends to be kind of a run stuffer in addition to rushing the passer. But it is puzzling. And look, I can't stand up here and tell you that he wouldn't have helped, because they didn't really pressure Kyler Murray. They didn't really get after him, and they planned on playing coverage and they're also, but hey, like people that say they need a pass rush. You're right. They do. And he was available for not all that much. And I don't buy the fact that it's strictly a salary cap thing. I don't think it's a matter of them just not having the room. They've pretty consistently chosen not to add Everson Griffin.
It's a pretty minimal amount of money that Detroit was taking on, too. It was $1.6 million or so.
Do they need to add somebody? And I guess that's the thing, because it looks to me that they might be just saying, hey, this is what we got.
That's what
do they need to add somebody?
Bump and I think so, yes. Yesterday, that was our conversation. You got to trade for somebody. And look, I'm not going to act like trading for an unrecognizable name is a priority. And I actually, when it comes to Everson Griffin, I'm not upset about this at all. I know that there are some that are saying right now, oh my goodness, how did you let him go? He was acquired for so cheap. Well, there's probably a reason that he was acquired for a conditional sixth round pick. There's not a lot of interest in him because he's probably not that good. And I also go back to his issues off the field in 2018, and I just wonder, do you really want to bring someone in when those issues have happened? I understand the idea of second chances and that your pass rush is not very good, but I actually trust the Seahawks' evaluation of Everson Griffin. I'm not upset about that. But you are right in that at some point they're going to have to bring in somebody. And I don't think you can just continue to stand pat. So by next Tuesday's trade deadline, I need to see someone here. And I don't care who it is. You know, I just making that effort to bring in somebody else, I think that's got to be a priority. Someone who has played in the league, who has experience. I don't need it to be a name. I just feel like you need more bodies that actually can get it done.
This becomes sort of a resource question in this regard. Any player that's available right now who has name recognition is a player whose cost exceeds their production. Ryan Kerrigan, Carlos Dunlap, guys that
J.J. Watt's
in that category where the team that's trading him sees the advantage of, hey, we're not going anywhere right now. And if someone takes this cost off our hand, it's worth it to us. We'll take this money and we'll either roll it over. We'll use it in an extension, but we're not going anywhere with this. So that's one, which is, okay, you pay for it with your pocketbook. You pay for a guy whose name recognition exceeds what you get from him on the field at this point. That's probably the move that will attract more attention. The other one is to get someone who's kind of marginally talented, honestly, who isn't that great, but you think can thrive in your system. And Everson Griffin is probably a player that would fall into that category of candidate, not because he fits in Seattle's system. Clearly, Seattle doesn't think he does. But someone, whether it's Jacob Martin with Houston, somebody who is not as much of a known commodity, isn't as expensive, but hey, he's not observably better than what you already have. And that's where Seattle's in a little bit of a tough. I don't want to see them go the name recognition route. I think that's the way you get fleeced, is you feel that pressure. Hey, we've got to do something. You hear Chris Collinsworth on Sunday night say, if the Seahawks don't get to the Super Bowl, it's because they don't have a pass rush. And so at the very least, you go and get someone who makes it sound like you're addressing the problem, right? Like, we went out and got J.J. Watt. No one's going to sit there and say this team refused to do anything.
No, everyone's going to say Super Bowl immediately after a name like that brought in.
Is he that good? Is he still have enough to make that sort of difference?
I wonder about that. And look, that cap situation, that's a lot. And there is also the J.J. Watt is a god in Houston dynamic that will mean he will cost a little bit more. I think, and Bill O'Brien's not there anymore, so the odds of Bill O'Brien moving a guy like J.J. Watt, I think the chances would be higher that you could get him for maybe a little bit less, because they'd probably be thinking to themselves right now, yeah, we just need to bring in assets seeing as we don't have any draft picks going forward. But that's the other thing, too. They're gonna want a lot in exchange for someone like that, and I think you would make the same case for even a Carlos Dunlap, who does have that history of success. Any one of those names, as you mentioned, who's got that brand recognition.
How much would you give up for Alden Smith?
Oh, man, he looks so good against the Seahawks.
I know. And he's a bigger dude. He's clearly very talented. You're not making a longer-term investment in him. How much would you give up for him?
I would definitely try to play up the fact that the guys had issues off the field as far as just a negotiating tactic to minimize the price. But I am willing to listen to whatever Dallas's counteroffer is. Yeah.
I mean, because that's honestly, and yeah, this would be my... If Dallas is, and the fact that they traded Griffin, maybe they think Smith has enough, and he hasn't played in a couple years, so there's not as much wear on his tires, and that he can be a piece that they could use next season. But fourth or fifth round pick is probably about the value that Alden Smith would command in a trade. He's not making a ton of money. He's not making more than Everson Griffin was. That might be the kind of guy that would be a good addition for them.
Physical freak compared to the Jadeveon Clowney rental, third round pick for Clowney, a fifth round pick for half a year of an older version of Jadeveon Clowney who's got all that freakish athleticism. Yeah, I would do that. And I have issues with a lot of the things that are on Alden Smith's past. I don't really enjoy the idea of giving a guy who's got some of that violence issues off the field that second chance, even if it was alcohol related. But you are at a point right now where if that's floated to you, fifth round pick for Alden Smith, I don't think you should even bat an eyelash. Make that deal.
It's Danny and Gallant. We will bring in Michael Bumpus next. We'll ask him about Everson Griffin and what the Seahawks should do at defensive end. That's next.